a busy man. The man who busies himself overmuch with the workings of his own soul cannot help being confronted by a common melancholy but rather curious phenomenon. Namely, he witnesses the sudden death of an insignificant memory that a chance occasion causes to be brought back from the humble and remote almshouse where it had been completing quietly its obscure existence. It blinks. It is still pulsating and reflecting light. But the next moment, under your very eyes, it breathes one last time and turns up its poor toes, having not withstood the too abrupt transit into the harsh glare of the present. Henceforth, all that remains at your disposal is the shadow, the abridgment of that recollection, now devoid, alas, of the original's bewitching convincingness. Grafitsky, a gentle-tempered and death-fearing person, remembered a boyhood dream which had contained a laconic prophecy, but he had ceased long ago to feel any organic link between himself and that memory, for at one of the first summonses it arrived looking wan and died, and the dream he now remembered was but the recollection of a recollection. When was it, that dream? Exact date unknown. Grafitsky answered, pushing away the little glass pot with smears of yogurt and leaning his elbow on the table. When? Come on, approximately. A long time ago. Presumably between the ages of 10 and 15. During that period, he often thought about death, especially at night. So here he is, a 32-year-old, smallish but broad-shouldered man with protruding, transparent ears, half-actor, half-literatus, author of topical jingles in the émigré papers over a not-very-witty pen name, unpleasantly reminding one of the Caron d'Ache adopted by an immortal cartoonist. Here he is. His face consists of horn-framed dark glasses with a blind man's glint in them, and of a soft, tufted wart on the left cheek. His head is balding, and through the straight strands of brushed-back dunnish hair one discerns the pale pink chamois of his scalp. What had he been thinking about just now? What was the recollection under which his jailed mind kept digging? The recollection of a dream. The warning addressed to him in a dream. A prediction, which up to now had in no way hampered his life, but which at present, at the inexorable approach of a certain deadline, was beginning to sound with an insistent, ever-increasing resonance.
"You must control yourself," cried Itsky to Graf in a hysterical recitative.
He cleared his throat and walked to the closed window. An ever-increasing insistence. The figure 33, the theme of that dream, had got entangled with his unconscious. Its curved claws, like those of a bat, had got caught in his soul. And there was no way to unravel that subliminal snarl. According to tradition, Jesus Christ lived to the age of 33. And perhaps, mused Graf, immobilized next to the cross of the casement frame, perhaps a voice in that dream had indeed said, "You'll die at Christ's age," and had displayed, illumined upon a screen, the thorns of two tremendous threes. He opened the window. It was lighter without than within, but street lamps had already started to glow. Smooth clouds blanketed the sky, and only westerward, between oakery housetops in an interspace, was banded with tender brightness. Farther up the street, a fiery-eyed automobile had stopped, its straight tangerine tusks plunged in the watery gray of the asphalt. A blond butcher stood on the threshold of his shop and contemplated the sky. As if crossing a stream from stone to stone, Graf's mind jumped from butcher to carcass and then to somebody who had been telling him that somebody else, somewhere, in a morgue, at a medical school, used to call a corpse fondly the Smully or Smullikins. "He's waiting around the corner, your Smullikins. Don't you worry. Smully won't let you down."
"Allow me to sort out various possibilities," said Graf with a snigger as he looked down askance from his fifth floor at the black iron spikes of a palisade. "Number one, the most vexing. I dream of the house being attacked or on fire. I leap out of bed and, thinking, we are fools in sleep, that I live at street level. I dive out of the window into an abyss. Second possibility, in a different nightmare, I swallow my tongue. That's known to have happened. The fat thing performs a back somersault in my mouth and I suffocate. Case number three, I'm roaming, say, through noisy streets. Aha, that's Pushkin trying to imagine his way of death. In combat, wanderings or waves, or will it be the nearby valley? Etc. But Mark, he began with combat, which means he did have a presentiment. Superstition may be masked wisdom. What can I do to stop thinking those thoughts? What can I do in my loneliness? He married in 1924 in Riga, coming from Pskov with a skimpy theatrical company. Was the coupleteer of the show, and when, before his act, he took off his spectacles to touch up with paint his deadish little face, one saw that he had eyes of a smoky blue. His wife was a large, robust woman with short black hair, a glowing complexion, and a fat, prickly nape. Her father sold furniture. Soon after marrying her, Graf discovered that she was stupid and coarse, that she had bow legs, and that, for every two Russian words, she used a dozen German ones. He realized that they must separate, but deferred the decision because of a kind of dreamy compassion he felt for her. And so things dragged until 1926, when she deceived him with the owner of a delicatessen on Lach Places Street. Graf moved from Riga to Berlin, where he was promised a job in a filmmaking firm, which soon folded up. He led an indigent, disorganized, solitary life and spent hours in a cheap pub where he wrote his topical poems. This was the pattern of his life, a life that made little sense, the meager, vapid existence of a third-rate Russian émigré. But as is well known, consciousness is not determined by this or that way of life. In times of comparative ease, as well as on such days when one goes hungry and one's clothes begin to rot, Grafitsky lived not unhappily, at least before the approach of the fateful year. With perfect good sense, he could be called a busy man, for the subject of his occupation was his own soul. And in such cases there can be no question of leisure, or indeed any necessity for it. We are discussing the air holes of life, a dropped heartbeat, pity, the eruptions of past things. What fragrance is that? What does it remind me of? And why does no one notice that on the dullest street every house is different? And what profusion there is on buildings, on furniture, on every object of seemingly useless ornaments, yes, useless, but full of disinterested, sacrificial enchantment. Let us speak frankly. There is many a person whose soul has gone to sleep like a leg. Per contra, there exist people endowed with principles, ideals, sick souls gravely affected by problems of faith and of morality. They are not artists of sensibility, but the soul is their mine where they dig and drill, working deeper and deeper with the coal-cutting machine of religious conscience, and getting giddy from the black dust of sins, small sins, pseudo-sins. Graf did not belong to their group. He lacked any special sins and had no special principles. He busied himself with his individual self as others study a certain painter or collect certain mites or decipher manuscripts rich in complex transpositions and insertions, with doodles, like hallucinations in the margin, and temperamental deletions that burn the bridges between masses of imagery, bridges whose restoration is such wonderful fun. His studies were now interrupted by alien considerations. This was unexpected and dreadfully painful. What should be done about it? After lingering by the window, and doing his best to find some defense against the ridiculous, trivial, but invincible idea that in a few days, on June the 19th, he would have attained the age mentioned in his boyhood dream, Graf quietly left his darkening room, in which all objects, buoyed up slightly by the waves of the crepuscule, no longer stood but floated like furniture during a great flood. It was still day, and somehow one's heart contracted from the tenderness of early lights. Graf noticed at once that not all was right, that a strange agitation was spreading around. People gathered at the corners of streets, made mysterious angular signals, walked over to the opposite side, and there again pointed at something afar, and then stood motionless in eerie attitudes of torpor. In the twilight dimness, nouns were lost. Only verbs remained, or at least the archaic forms of a few verbs. This kind of thing might mean a lot, for example, the end of the world. Suddenly, with a numbing tingle in every part of his frame, he understood. There, across the deep vista between buildings, outlined softly against a clear golden background, under the lower rim of a long ashen cloud, very low, very far, and very slowly, and also ash-colored, also elongated, an airship was floating by. The exquisite antique loveliness of its motion, mating with the intolerable beauty of the evening sky, tangerine lights, blue silhouettes of people, caused the contents of Graf's soul to brim over. He saw it as a celestial token, an old-fashioned apparition, reminding him that he was on the point of reaching the established limit of his life. He read in his mind the inexorable obituary. Our valuable collaborator, so early in life, we who knew him so well, fresh humor, fresh grave. And what was still more inconceivable, all around that obituary, to paraphrase Pushkin again, indifferent nature would be shining. The flora of a newspaper, weeds of domestic news, burdocks of editorials. On a quiet summer night he turned 33. Alone in his room, clad in long underpants, striped like those of a convict, glassless and blinking, he celebrated his unbidden birthday. He had not invited anybody because he feared such contingencies as a broken pocket mirror or some talk about life's fragility, which the retentive mind of a guest would be sure to promote to the rank of an omen. Stay, stay a moment. Thou art not as fair as Goethe's, but nevertheless, stay. Here we have an unrepeatable individual in an unrepeatable medium. The storm-felled worn books on the shelves, the little glass pot of yogurt said to lengthen life, the tufted brush for cleaning one's pipe, the stout album of an ashen tint in which Graf pasted everything, beginning with the clippings of his verse and finishing with a Russian tram ticket. These are the surroundings of Graf Itzky, a pen name he had thought up on a rainy night while waiting for the next ferry, a butterfly-eared, husky little man who sat on the edge of his bed holding the holy violet sock he had just taken off. Henceforth he began to fear everything. The lift, a draft, builders' scaffolds, the traffic, demonstrators, a truck-mounted platform for the repairing of trolley wires, the colossal dome of the gas house that might explode right when he passed by on his way to the post office, where, furthermore, a bold bandit in a homemade mask might go on a shooting spree. He realized the silliness of his state of mind, but was unable to overcome it. In vain did he try to divert his attention, to think of something else. On the footboard, at the back of every thought that went speeding by like a sledded carriage, stood Smully, the ever-present groom. On the other hand, the topical poems with which he continued diligently to supply the papers became more and more playful and artless, since nobody should note in them, retrospectively, the presentiment of nearing death. And those wooden couplets whose rhythm recalled the seesaw of the Russian toy featuring a muzhik and a bear, and in which shrilly rhymed with Djugashvili. Those couplets, and not anything else, turned out to be actually the most substantial and fitty piece of his being. Naturally, faith in the immortality of the soul is not forbidden.
but there is one terrible question which nobody to my knowledge has set," mused Graf over a mug of beer. "May not the soul's passage into the hereafter be attended with the possibility of random impediments and vicissitudes similar to the various mishaps surrounding a person's birth in this world? Cannot one help that passage to succeed by taking, while still alive, certain psychological or even physical measures? Which, specifically? What must one foresee? What must one stock? What must one avoid? Should one regard religion," argued Graf, dallying in the deserted, darkened pub where the chairs were already yawning and being put to bed on the tables, "religion, which covers the walls of life with sacred pictures, as something on the lines of that attempt to create a favorable setting, rather in the same way as, according to certain physicians, the photographs of professional babies with nice, chubby cheeks, by adorning the bedroom of a pregnant woman, act beneficially on the fruit of her womb. But even if the necessary measures have been taken, even if we do know why Mr. X, who fed on this or that, milk, music, or whatever, safely crossed over into the hereafter, while Mr. Y, whose nourishment was slightly different, got stuck and perished, might there not exist other hazards capable of occurring at the very moment of passing over, and somehow getting in one's way, spoiling everything? For mind you, even animals or plain people creep away when their hour approaches. Do not hinder. Do not hinder me in my difficult, perilous task. Allow me to be delivered peacefully of my immortal soul." All this depressed Graf. But meaner yet and more terrible was the thought of there not being any hereafter at all, that a man's life bursts as irremediably as the bubbles that dance and vanish in a tempestuous tub under the jaws of a rainpipe. Graf watched them from the veranda of the suburban café. It was raining hard. Autumn had come. 4 months had elapsed since he had reached the fatidic age. Death might hit any minute now. And those trips to the dismal pine barrens near Berlin were extremely risky. If, however, thought Graf, there is no hereafter, then away with it goes everything else that involves the idea of an independent soul. Away goes the possibility of omens and presentiments. All right, let us be materialists. And therefore I, a healthy individual with a healthy heredity, shall probably live half a century more. And so why yield to neurotic illusions? They are only the result of a certain temporary instability of my social class, and the individual is immortal inasmuch as his class is immortal. And the great class of the bourgeoisie, continued Graf, now thinking aloud with disgusting animation, our great and powerful class shall conquer the hydra of the proletariat. For we, too, slave owners, corn merchants, and their loyal troubadours, must step onto the platform of our class. More zip, please. We all, the bourgeois of all countries, the bourgeois of all lands and nations, arise. Our oil-mad or gold-mad collective, down with plebeian miscreations. And now any verbal adverb ending in eve will do as a rhyme. After that, two more strophes, and again, up, bourgeois of all lands and nations, long live our sacred capital. Tra-ta-ta. Anything in Asians. Our bourgeois international. Is the result witty? Is it amusing? Winter came. Graf borrowed 50 marks from a neighbor and used the money to eat his fill, since he was not prepared to allow fate the slightest loophole. That odd neighbor, who of his own accord had offered financial assistance, was a newcomer occupying the two best rooms of the fifth floor, called Ivan Ivanovich Engel, a sort of stoutish gentleman with gray locks, resembling the accepted type of a composer or chess maestro, but in point of fact representing some kind of foreign, very foreign perhaps, Far Eastern or Celestial firm. When they happened to meet in the corridor, he smiled kindly, shyly, and poor Graf
explained this sympathy by assuming his neighbor to be a businessman of no culture, remote from literature and other mountain resorts of the human spirit, and thus instinctively bearing for him, Grafitsky, the dreamer, a delicious, thrilling esteem. Anyway, Graf had too many troubles to pay much attention to his neighbor, but in a rather absent-minded way he kept availing himself of the old gentleman's angelic nature, and on nights of unendurable nicotinelessness, for example, would knock at Mr. Ingle's door and obtain a cigar, but did not really grow chummy with him, and indeed never asked him in, except that time when the desk lamp burned out and the landlady had chosen that evening for going to the cinema, and the neighbor brought a brand new bulb and delicately screwed it in. On Christmas, Graf was invited by some literary friends to a yolka, Yule tree party, and through the motley talk told himself with a sinking heart that he saw those colored baubles for the last time. Once, in the middle of a serene February night, he kept looking too long at the firmament and suddenly felt unable to suffer the burden and pressure of human consciousness, that ominous and ludicrous luxury. A detestable spasm made him gasp for breath, and the monstrous star-stained sky swung into motion. Graf curtained the window and, holding one hand to his heart, knocked with the other at Ivan Engel's door. The latter, with a mild smile and a slight German accent, offered him some Valerianka. It so happened, by the way, that when Graf entered, he caught Mr. Engel standing in the middle of his bedroom and distilling the calmative into a wine glass, no doubt for his own use, holding the glass in his right hand and raising high the left one with the dark amber bottle. He silently moved his lips, counting 12, 13, 14, and then very rapidly, as if running on tiptoe, 15, 16, 17, and again slowly to 20. He wore a canary-yellow dressing gown. A pince-nez straddled the tip of his attentive nose. And after another period of time came spring, and a smell of mastic pervaded the staircase. In the house just across the street, someone died, and for quite a while there was a funereal automobile standing there, of a glossy black like a grand piano. Graf was tormented by nightmares. He thought he saw tokens in everything. The merest coincidence frightened him. The folly of chance is the logic of fate. How not to believe in fate, in the infallibility of its promptings, in the obstinacy of its purpose, when its black lines persistently show through the handwriting of life? The more one heeds coincidences, the more often they happen. Graf reached a point when, having thrown away the newspaper sheet out of which he, an amateur of misprints, had cut out the phrase, "After a song and painful illness," he saw a few days later that same sheet with its neat little window in the hands of a market woman who was wrapping up a head of cabbage for him. And the same evening, from beyond the remotest roofs, a misty and malignant cloud began to swell, engulfing the first stars, and one suddenly felt such a suffocating heaviness as if carrying upstairs on one's back a huge iron-forged trunk. And presently, without warning, the sky lost its balance and the huge chest clattered down the steps. Graf hastened to close and curtain the casement, for as is well known, drafts and electric light attract thunderbolts. A flash shone through the blinds, and to determine the distance of the lightning's fall, he used the domestic method of counting. The thunderclap came at the count of 6, which meant 6 versts. The storm increased. Dry thunderstorms are the worst. The window panes shook and rumbled. Graf went to bed, but then imagined so vividly the lightning striking the roof any moment now, passing through all 7 floors and transforming him, on the way, into a convulsively contracted negro, that he jumped out of bed with a pounding heart. Through the blind the casement flashed, the black cross of its sash cast a fleeting shadow upon the wall, and, producing loud clanging sounds in the dark, he removed from the washstand and placed on the floor a heavy faience basin, rigorously wiped, and stood in it, shivering, his bare toes squeaking against the earthenware, virtually all night, until dawn put a stop to the nonsense. During the May thunderstorm, Graf descended to the most humiliating depths of transcendental cowardice. In the morning, a break occurred in his mood. He considered the merry, bright blue sky, the arborescent designs of dark humidity crossing the drying asphalt, and realized that only one more month remained until the 19th of June. On that day, he would be 34. Land! But would he be able to swim that distance? Could he hold out? He hoped he could. Zestfully, he decided to take extraordinary measures to protect his life from the claims of fate. He stopped going out. He did not shave. He pretended to be ill. His landlady took care of his meals, and through her Mr. Ingle would transmit to him an orange, a magazine, or laxative powder in a dainty little envelope. He smoked less and slept more. He worked out the crosswords in the émigré papers, breathed through his nose, and before going to bed was careful to spread a wet towel over his bedside rug in order to be at once awakened by its chill, if his body tried in a somnambulistic trance to sneak past the surveillance of thought. Would he make it? June the 1st, June the 2nd, June the 3rd. On the 10th, the neighbor inquired through the door if he was all right. The 11th, the 12th, the 13th. Like that world-famous Finnish runner who throws away, before the last lap, his nickel-plated watch, which has helped him to compute his strong, smooth course, so Graf, on seeing the end of the track, abruptly changed his mode of action. He shaved off his straw-colored beard, took a bath, and invited guests for the 19th. He did not give in to the temptation of celebrating his birthday one day earlier, as slyly advised by the imps of the calendar. He was born in the previous century, when there were 12, not 13 days between the old style and the new, by which he lived now. But he did write to his mother in Pskov, asking her to apprise him of the exact hour of his birth. Her reply, however, was rather evasive. "It happened at night. I remember being in great pain." The 19th dawned. All morning his neighbor could be heard walking up and down in his room, displaying unusual agitation, and even running out into the corridor whenever the front door bell rang, as if he awaited some message. Graf did not invite him to the evening party. They hardly knew each other, after all. But he did ask the landlady, for Graf's nature oddly united absent-mindedness and calculation. In the late afternoon he went out, bought vodka, meat patties, smoked herring, black bread. On his way home, as he was crossing the street with the unruly provisions in his unsteady embrace, he noticed Mr. Engel, illumined by the yellow sun, watching him from the balcony. Around 8 o'clock, at the very moment that Graf, after nicely laying the table, leaned out of the window, the following happened. At the corner of the street, where a small group of men had collected in front of the pub, loud, angry cries rang out, followed suddenly by the cracking of pistol shots. Graf had the impression that a stray bullet whistled past his face, almost smashing his glasses, and with an "ach" of terror, he drew back. From the hallway came the sound of the front doorbell. Trembling, Graf peeped out of his room, and simultaneously, Ivan Ivanovich Engel, in his canary-yellow dressing gown, swept into the hallway. It was a messenger with the telegram he had been awaiting all day. Engel opened it eagerly and beamed with joy. "Was dort für Skandala?" asked Graf, addressing the messenger. But the latter, baffled no doubt by his questioner's bad German, did not understand, and when Graf very cautiously looked out of the window again, the sidewalk in front of the pub was empty. The janitors sat on chairs near their porches, and a bare-calved housemaid was walking a pinkish toy poodle. At about 9 all the guests were there, 3 Russians and the German landlady. She brought 5 liqueur glasses and a cake of her own making. She was an ill-formed woman in a rustling violet dress with prominent cheekbones, a freckled neck, and the wig of a comedy mother-in-law. Graf's gloomy friends, emigre men of letters, all of them elderly, ponderous people, with various ailments, the tale of which always comforted Graf, immediately got the landlady drunk, and got tight themselves without growing merrier. The conversation was, of course, conducted in Russian. The landlady did not understand a word of it, yet giggled, rolled in futile coquetry her poorly penciled eyes, and kept up a private soliloquy. But nobody listened to her. Graf, every now and then, consulted his wristwatch under the table, yearned for the nearest church tower to strike midnight, drank orange juice, and took his pulse. By midnight the vodka gave out and the landlady, staggering and laughing her head off, fetched a bottle of cognac.
"Well, your health, Staraya Morda."
"Old fright," one of the guests coldly addressed her, and she naively, trustfully, clinked glasses with him, and then stretched toward another drinker, but he brushed her away. At sunrise, Grafitsky said goodbye to his guests. On the little table in the hallway there lay, he noticed, now torn open and discarded, the telegram that had so delighted his neighbor. Graf abstractly read it. "Soglashen prodleni." Extension agreed. Then he returned to his room, introduced some order, and, yawning, replete with a strange sense of boredom, as if he had planned the length of his life according to the prediction and now had to start its construction all over again, sat down in an armchair and flipped through a dilapidated book, somebody's birthday present, a Russian anthology of good stories and puns published in the Far East. "How's your son, the poet?"
"He's a sadist now."
"Meaning?"
"He writes only sadistics."
Gradually, Graf dozed off in his chair, and in his dream he saw Ivan Ivanovich Engel singing couplets in a garden of sorts and fanning his bright yellow, curly-feathered wings. And when Graf woke up, the lovely June sun was lighting little rainbows in the landlady's liqueur glasses, and everything was somehow soft and luminous and enigmatic, as if there was something he had not understood, not thought through to the end, and now it was already too late. Another life had begun, the past had withered away, and death had quite removed the meaningless memory, summoned by chance from the distant and humble home where it had been living out its obscure existence.